Hello, everyone, and welcome to McGill Care's webcast series supporting family and informal caregivers. I'm Claire Webster, a former caregiver, certified dementia care consultant, and founder of McGill University's Dementia Education Program. I work with a dynamic team of leading healthcare professionals to oversee the program, who include Dr. José Marais from the Division of Geriatric Medicine and Dr. Serge Gauthier, Professor Emeritus, formerly of the McGill University Research Center for Studies in Aging. McGill Cares is supported by the Amelia Saputo Community Outreach for Dementia Care. I'd just like everyone to know that at mcgill.ca/dementia, we have a wide variety of free resources to support persons living with dementia and their care partners, including this amazing Dementia Companion Guide that is now available in 8 different languages: English, French, Spanish, Italian, Greek, Portuguese, Punjabi, and Mandarin, with many more languages to come. You can either download it for free or you can purchase a copy at Amazon, which supports our program. We also have numerous virtual support programs in collaboration with the Alzheimer's Society of Montreal, as well as multiple episodes of McGill Cares that you can go back and listen to either on YouTube or on Spotify. So today we're going to be talking about the impact of alcohol on cognitive and cardiovascular health, which is a very important topic. I'm extremely pleased to have as my guest today, Dr. Christopher Labos. Dr. Labos is a cardiologist who also has a degree in epidemiology. He's an associate of the McGill University Office of Science and Society, and he's a freelance contributor to the Montreal Gazette, CJAD. He also appears on CBC and CTV. I'm so happy to meet you, Chris, in person because I often hear you on the radio. Thank you for being on McGill Cares.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So I thought you'd be a great person to talk about the subject, you know, especially with your degree in cardiology. And I know that you've written a lot of articles on this topic in newspapers. I hear you a lot on the radio discussing it. And so, you know, there's so many mixed messages about alcohol, right? Whether it's good for you, it's not good for you. And right now, the new Canada Health Guidelines released in January this year suggest that we should limit our intake to 2 servings per week. Maybe you can, you know, shed some light on this whole topic for us.
Yeah, sure. So I think what's interesting, though, about what was recently released, we're not technically speaking guidelines because they didn't say everybody should drink less than 2 drinks per week. What they said was the risk for alcohol-related complications starts going up at much lower levels than people realize. So even if you're drinking 1 to 2 drinks per week, or if you're drinking more than that, the risk, especially the cancer risk, does start to go up. Now, it goes up by, you know, a fairly small amount, but it does go up. And I think the main point of the guidelines was not so much to give people, you see, even I call it guidelines, even though they weren't actually guidelines. They weren't exactly to give people a recommendation of what to do, but they were about highlighting a scientific reality that I think a lot of people ignore, which is that alcohol is not good for you. Alcohol increases the risk of cancer. It increases the risk of several cancers, specifically breast cancer, as well as a lot of the other GI cancers like liver cancer and some forms of colorectal cancer. But what's interesting is that a lot of people just don't know that this is true. And, you know, while we understand that smoking is bad for you, while we understand that diabetes is bad for you, while we understand that sedentary behavior is bad for you, as much as we may not do anything about it, as much as we may live sedentary lifestyles and maybe not exercise as much as we do, we at least understand and acknowledge that sedentary behavior is not good for you. But what's interesting about alcohol is that to some degree, we just deny the reality that alcohol is bad for you and that it makes your health worse. And this is true whether it comes to blood pressure or arrhythmias or risk of heart failure or risk of cardiac disease or risk of cancer. And we kind of are blissfully unaware of this and continue along our daily lives. And to some extent, we take it so far to the other extreme that we've actually convinced ourselves that alcohol is in fact good for you, which is almost the exact opposite of what the data show. So I think this was really the point of what we've been talking about for the past month. You know, the realization that when you review the data and review the evidence, the risk of alcohol actually does increase even with very, very low levels of consumption. So let me show you what I mean. if you take data from some of the major studies that have been done with alcohol, and this is a slide from one of the graphics from one of the analyses done from The Lancet, which is one of the major papers that was reviewed, what you see is that when you look at alcohol consumption, the risk for all-cause mortality, so death from any cause, does start to go up, and it goes up at a much lower level than people realize. 100 grams of alcohol per week is about one drink per day. More or less. What's also very complicated about these types of analyses is that what constitutes a standard drink is different country to country, which makes comparisons hard and makes it confusing for the general public. But what you see is that the risk of alcohol goes up. And while most of us agree that, okay, if you're drinking many drinks per week, the risk is going to be much higher, I think people fail to realize at where the inflection point is. And it's actually a lot lower. Whereas most people probably drink somewhere around 200 grams of alcohol per week, the risk starts to go up at basically less than half of that. So it's much higher than people realize. And when you look at some of the analyses that have been done, this is another paper from the BMJ. When you look at the risk of cancer specifically, and this is just the data in women, there's a similar table in men if you want to go back to the original paper. When you look at alcohol-related cancers, and what they define as alcohol-related cancers was colorectum, so colon and rectal cancer, breast cancer in women, and cancer of the oral cavity, the pharynx, the larynx, the liver, and the esophagus. So the cancers that are most sensitive to alcohol consumption. When you look at that, what you realize is that when you're drinking 5 to 15 grams per day, which is, less than a drink per day, your risk actually goes up. Now, it doesn't go up by a very, very high amount, right? But it's not trivial. And I think that's the point, is that the risk is not zero. So the very nuanced argument that we have to have is that it's not that you can't drink per se. It's not that, everybody has to become a teetotaler. It's that alcohol is not health food. And trying to explain that to people to say, like, no, a lot of what you've heard about the cardiovascular benefits or the health benefits of alcohol is actually not true, is that your risk is going to go up even with very, very low levels of consumption. And I think that's the point that we have to do, because yes, you can make a choice to drink alcohol, but it should be an informed choice. And it should be based on actual evidence, not on the misconceptions that a lot of people have.
So it's so difficult, because it plays a big role in our social lives. It's part of celebrations. It's part of, gatherings. It's in the media. I mean, every single show you watch, it's out there. So how bad is it? Like, first of all, what would be the impact on our cognitive and cardiovascular health? Like you talk about cancers, but how would it impact, our cognitive and cardiovascular health?
Yeah. So, I mean, just before we get into the dry science, let me point out something to you. What you just said, like, alcohol is so much part of our lives. You could have easily said that about smoking 50 years ago, right? You could have literally replaced the word alcohol with smoking 50 years ago, and people would have made the same argument. They're like, but everybody smokes. If you just smoke a little bit, it's not that bad. It's what you do when you go to a party. You're like, if you go to a bar, what am I going to do with my hands? I have to smoke. I mean, people used to say things that if you try to explain those arguments to a 20-year-old today, they would strike you as bizarre. Don't forget, when we tried to pass anti-smoking laws for indoor building, a lot of people was like, well, no one's going to go to bars and restaurants if you can't smoke, right? Mm-hmm. People said those things. Clearly, that wasn't true, because we passed those laws and bars and restaurants continue to exist. So change is always hard. And we human beings are surprisingly bad at change as a species, right? We have this sort of knee-jerk reaction towards the status quo. But it doesn't have to be that way. So yes, alcohol is a common part of our lives, but it doesn't have to be. And again, it's not that you can't drink alcohol in the same way that it's not that you can't. And here's the thing, you can drink alcohol in the same way that you can eat ice cream or eat French fries or binge watch a 9-hour show on Netflix. But none of that is good for you. So you can do it. You just have to do it with the understanding that it's not good for you. And with the understanding that if you drank less alcohol, you would be better off, because Think about this. Alcohol is not great for your blood pressure. It raises your blood pressure. It has a lot of sugar in it. So it's not great if you have diabetes. It makes you gain weight. It increases your risk of cancer. And so there's a lot about alcohol that is very negative. Alcohol also not great for arrhythmias. It is a mild stimulant. So it does cause palpitations in some people. It can predispose people to arrhythmias. There have been studies where they took people with a very common heart arrhythmia like atrial fibrillation. And these were people who drank, you know, fairly high levels. They were drinking, I think, over 10 drinks per week at baseline. They got them to cut back down to near zero. There was a substantial improvement in their arrhythmia burden. So there's a lot of benefits that you can get from alcohol, from cutting back on alcohol. The problem is that when you talk about that, it's like, oh, but there's cardiovascular benefits. And it's the idea of the French paradox, right? The red wine is
good. Is it that they drink a lot of, you know, lots of red wine, they eat, you know, the cheeses and the wonderful cold cuts, and they are like, are some people more predisposed to getting cancer and all these, whereas others aren't? Like,
yeah, so there's definitely a genetic factor that goes into all of this. But the thing about the French paradox, okay, is that it's probably not true. So let's explore the history of where this comes from. What's interesting about the French paradox is that it really can be traced back to the original 60 Minutes story that Morley Safer did back in 1991. And it was an interesting video. You can actually go back and watch it. You know, it's still available if you can find it on the right websites. But what's interesting about this story is that if you actually watch it beginning to end, a lot of the issues that they were talking about are no longer really valid anymore. Because don't remember, this story aired in 1991. It was largely based on research from the late 80s. And it was trying to explain why there were differences in cardiovascular disease between France and countries like the UK and the US. So first, before we get into the nitty-gritty, there's a lot of differences between France, the UK, and the US in terms of the healthcare system, in terms of their baseline risk factors, in terms of obesity rates, in terms of sedentary behavior, a lot of other stuff that is probably more important to the issue of heart disease, access to a healthcare system, right? If you have a lot of people who don't have access to healthcare and they're walking around with high blood pressure that's undiagnosed, well, of course, you're going to have higher rates of heart disease. The other thing, too, is that the context in which we live is radically different. I think we know now that if you want to prevent heart disease, number one, you have to be much better at screening and treating people's risk factors like high blood pressure, cholesterol, getting people to quit smoking, which is probably the most important thing that has led to the decrease in cardiovascular disease. And if you want to prevent out-of-hospital cardiac mortality, it's having defibrillators in public spaces that if somebody does go into cardiac arrest, you can shock them to keep them alive, to get them to hospital so that their artery can be opened up. So there's a lot of different factors that play into it, and to attribute it solely to red wine is, I think, a bit overly simplistic. The other issue is that over the years, people have looked at this and have really questioned if heart disease rates between the US and France are really all that different, because the way different countries label and code diagnoses for heart disease is a little bit different. There are also issues of, like, you know, heart disease is such a long-term thing. If you're going to look at heart disease rates in the 1980s, you almost have to look at dietary patterns back in the 1950s. And that's a little bit complicated to do, because when you're talking about Europe as a whole, don't forget, post-World War II, there was a major disruption to the European diet because of widespread economic devastation and near famine in some countries after World War II. So the whole issue is much, much more complicated. And the idea that there's this significant difference between France and the US is, I don't think, quite justifiable. And if you actually watch the 60 Minutes news story, they were blaming a lot of it on cheese. And they were like, cheese and milk, that's what's bad. And that's what causes heart disease. When I think now, I think we can say fairly safely that, you know, the fat in milk is probably such a trivial contribution to overall risk that I don't think we can really base ourselves too much on what they were saying. Cholesterol matters, but there's a difference between the cholesterol in your blood and the fat that you eat in your food. But that is a topic for another seminar, perhaps. But so bear in mind that this is really where it comes from. And what's fascinating about this 60 Minute story is that it is really stuck in the public imagination. And ever since this story aired in 1991, sales of red wine in North America shot up, almost exclusively because of this news story. And you know, this happens to me all the time. I get people to come into my office and we go through their risk factors and we say, how's everything going? Yeah, pretty good. Blood pressure is good, everything. And then I've had people literally come up to me and say, you know, the only problem I have is that it's really hard for me to drink two glasses of red wine a day because I really don't like the taste of wine. I've literally had people say that to me, and it's really hard because I'm like, I try to, but look, you don't have to drink wine if you don't want to. Like, it's not, drinking wine is not part of a heart healthy diet. And it comes up more often than you would think. And it's because people do believe in this U-shaped association, and there is data to back it up. So this is the same Lancet paper that I showed you earlier. If you look at rates of cardiovascular disease, there is this dip, this U-shaped association, you know, with low levels of alcohol consumption. So when you're at about 100 grams of alcohol per week, there does seem to be this little dip. And people say, aha, you see, if I was drinking zero, I would be at higher risk than if I drank 100. And that's fine until you realize that there's a problem with these types of associations, because most of these studies are what we call observational studies. They're not randomized trials. They're not taking people and telling them, you drink two glasses a week, you drink zero, and let's see what happened over the next 10 years. They just basically ask people, how much do you drink? So people are able to choose for themselves how much alcohol they drink. And you have to realize that when people decide how much alcohol they can drink, the people who drink more alcohol are going to be fundamentally different than the people who drink less alcohol in many different ways. And so this is a diagram that I like to use when I teach this point, because if you were to look at this association between alcohol and heart failure, you would see a U-shaped association. You would be like, ah, you see, the people who drink zero are at the highest risk. So I should drink a little bit, but not too much, because then the risk starts to go up after, you know, 1 to 2 drinks per day. And this is what most people believe. But there's a problem when you think about the people who drink zero, because there's basically two types of people who drink no alcohol. There's people who never drank alcohol, and there's people who used to drink alcohol and then quit. And those are two very different groups. And when you divide those out, then you notice a problem. The people who are at higher risk are not the people who never drank alcohol. They are the people who used to drink alcohol and then quit, because they probably quit for a reason. They were probably told to quit by their doctor because they had high blood pressure or diabetes, or they were gaining weight, or they were at higher risk for cancer, or they had some sort of medical problem. And so this highlights an issue called reverse causation, or the sick quitter effect, because it's not that the people who abstain from alcohol get sick. It's that people who are sick end up abstaining from alcohol. So it's the reverse of what you actually think. And this is a very well-established statistical phenomenon. And it probably explains why you have this, you know, seeming protective benefit from alcohol. Because it's not actually true. Like the thing that people often talk about in terms of antioxidants with alcohol, oh, alcohol has resveratrol in it. Well, they've actually studied resveratrol in terms of, does it increase mortality or does it decrease mortality or not? And it doesn't. They've done studies like this and it hasn't actually borne out to be true. And part of the problem is that there's just not enough resveratrol in red wine or most foods to actually make much of a difference. I mean, to get enough resveratrol, to get the 1 gram a day that you probably need to make a difference, you would have to drink, you know, over 1,000 liters of red wine per day. And that would, of course, kill you, right? And even if you wanted to be more conservative and say you only need a half, you know, half as much, it's still impossible to drink enough red wine to get enough antioxidants like resveratrol for it to actually affect your health. So the red wine isn't actually doing anything beneficial for you. It's just sort of a thing that we tell ourselves because we want to feel good about what we already do and what is essentially a habit. And I think that's the point that we have to get away from, is that alcohol is not actually good for you. The assumption that we've made that alcohol is good for you is actually a statistical artifact that we can easily explain away.
So we talk a lot about red wine, but you know, I know a lot of like friends of mine or something, they say, well, you know what? I just drink tequila because tequila doesn't have any calories. It's clean, right? So is there, okay. Or, you know, what about people have just a little sip of Jack Daniels at the end of the day? Like, is there Okay. I know that you said it's not good, but are there alcohols that could be better for you than others that may lower the risk?
No, because alcohol is a sugar. I mean, the only thing that would be non-harmful is if you were to drink a non-alcoholic version of whatever drink you want, which, you know, those things do exist, right? The difference between alcohols is, first of all, the source and the flavorings, right? But at its core, alcohol, if we're going to talk about the molecule of alcohol, alcohol is a sugar. Mm-hmm. And it's metabolized by your liver into waste products and then eventually stored as extra energy in terms of fat. So you are just consuming calories. You are essentially consuming a sugary drink. And, you know, and here's the thing, we understand that excessive amounts of sugar are not good for you. Like, we understand that sugary drinks are not good for you. Like, we know that. And yet in our brain, we've created this justification like, well, but no, alcohol is not really a sugary drink. Well, it is, if you want to think of it from the purely biochemicals perspective. So, and when they've done these types of associations, in fact, the same type of statistical patterns emerge regardless of the type of alcohol that you drink. You know, whether it's red wine or white wine, there tends not to be that much of a difference when you look at the sum total of the thing. And even when you look at hard liquor and spirits, it doesn't really seem to make much of a difference. You can prefer one or the other. You can find that you tolerate one better the other. But in terms of the biochemical properties of what it's doing in your body, your liver doesn't know whether the ethanol that you just consumed came from a grape or a potato. It just knows that it's ethanol. It's going to metabolize it the same way because the molecule of ethanol, what we call alcohol, is the same regardless of what its original provenance was.
Okay, so here's another question. So the non-alcoholic industry is booming right now, right? There's a lot of companies coming out with non-alcoholic wine, non-alcoholic gin, non-alcoholic beer. And because you're talking about the source of the problem is with the sugar, is there any difference then to drink? I mean, there are people who are trying to quit, let's say dry January, they'll say, okay, I'm just going to have non-alcoholic beer, non-alcoholic wine. Is that as bad for you as regular alcohol?
I mean, probably not. I mean, this hasn't been studied. Like, no one's ever done a trial. We're going to compare, you know, alcoholic beer to non-alcoholic beer. A lot of it's going to depend in what's in it. And so it's not the label. I was going to say it's not the label that matters. It's the label that matters because you have to look to see what is in this thing that you're drinking, right? Mm-hmm. If they've just replaced the alcohol with another type of sugar and it's the same number of calories and the same amount of sugar, I'm not sure you're any better off. I mean, you're going to at least remove the issues in terms of drunk driving and the, you know, psychosocial aspects of alcohol consumption, which we haven't really talked about. But if you're looking at it purely from the cardiometabolic perspective, it depends what's in there. If you've replaced your alcohol with, you know, a drink that's a low calorie drink with no sugar, then yeah, you probably are better off in the same way that if take sugar or take salt out of a pre-existing product. Anytime you drink less of something that's bad for you, the better off you're going to be. So it really depends what's in the product that you're drinking. That's why you actually have to look at the label and try to make sense of what's on the packaging. One of the big issues that we have with food labeling is that they are actually extremely complex and they're not easy for most people to understand. They're often in very small print. They're like, what are all these things? And so there has been a push over the past few years to simplify the labeling of foods, so that it's much clearer to people how much salt is in there, how much sugar is in there, how much fat is in there. So you actually know what it is that you're actually eating. So you can look at something and be like, oh, that's actually not as healthy as I thought it was.
So let's talk about how do we know when, you know, alcohol dependency can become an addiction. Like, you know, when I'm looking at, you know, I mean, I was a former caregiver, alcohol was my go-to for me, or a lot of people with, you know, come home from work dealing with stress. But how do we know that when it gets to the point of you becoming addicted as opposed to just dependent, you know, that how do we know? What are the warning signs?
Well, so here's the thing. There's a great episode of MASH that I really like. And the plot of the episode was the other characters had made a bet with Hawkeye that he couldn't go a week without drinking, because one of the running gags on the show was that they had their own still in their tent and they would make their own alcohol. And so the other character telling me is like, you know, he looks like, you know, you're drinking a bit much. And so they made a bet with him to go a week not to drink. And so that was sort of the through plot of the episode, and other stuff happened. And then at the end, you know, they had the patients come in, they did their surgeries, they were all exhausted. They go to the bar that they had set up and Hawkeye goes to order a drink. And the other characters are all disappointed. They're like, oh, come on, you almost made it. You almost made it the full week. And he said, hey, listen, I had a hard week. I need this. So he picks up the glass and he looks at it and he says, And then he puts it down and he says, I'll come back when I want it. And I think that's the point. It's okay to want to drink alcohol. It's not okay to need to drink alcohol. Yeah. And when it gets to the point where you have to do it, where you can't stop, that starts to become a problem. It's, you know, it's a very difficult thing to diagnose. It's a very subtle thing to diagnose. And there's a lot of self-denial that goes into it. But here's the thing. You know, it's, if you look at it as an indulgence, is if you look at it as essentially something akin to liquid dessert, it's fine to have dessert, right? Because it's pleasurable. It tastes good. We all like ice cream because it's fun to eat ice cream. But if you ever got to the point where you had to have ice cream every day, you would start to realize that there was a problem there. And I think this is the point, is that alcohol shouldn't be part of our routine because it's not good for you health-wise, but it's also not good for it to become something that's programmed into our brain that we should be drinking every day. Like, no, you shouldn't drink alcohol every day. It's not that great for you. And so breaking that cycle, breaking that association in our brain is probably a good thing in the long term.
So what recommendations would you have for people who would like to reduce or stop? There's this whole mixed feeling about, is it good to go cold turkey? Yeah. Or like, what would you recommend to people?
So for people who have abused alcohol over the long term, there is a risk of abruptly stopping alcohol. There is a neurological condition called delirium tremens, where if you stop drinking alcohol abruptly, you can start to have neurovascular problems. It can progress to seizures and even death. There is a way to treat it. And of course, you do have to sort of cut back slowly and wean yourself off the problem. But that's really for the people who, you know, have abused alcohol for many, many years and who have, a very, very severe alcohol addiction. For the person who's just in the habit of drinking 1 to 2 drinks per day or more, or listen, I'll be honest with you. Listen, we haven't really talked about the dosing yet. And this is an important part. Let's say you're the type of person who's like, you know, my husband and I, we open up a bottle of wine for dinner and we split it between the two of us. That's too much alcohol, because most people don't realize how many glasses of wine are in a bottle. Because most people think it's like, oh, you split a bottle of wine between two people. That's actually too much. There's actually 5 servings of alcohol in a bottle of wine. So a bottle of wine should be enough for 5 people. So we drink too much. If you've ever been to a restaurant and you see the little lines that they have on glasses and they're like, ah, they poured me so little wine. No, that's actually what a standard drink of wine is. Wine glasses are not meant to be filled to the top. If you're doing that, you're drinking too much wine. So we think we're drinking moderate alcohol consumption and we're going far, far beyond what the guidelines are. We're actually very bad at doing this. They've actually done studies where they took people and asked them to free pour servings of alcohol. And they all overpoured. They all overdid it. So right at baseline, we're drinking too much. And so the first thing we could do is reduce our serving sizes. Get back to what an actual serving size of alcohol truly is. And it's also, I think, important to not make it a daily thing. Because if you make it part of your routine, it becomes very hard to stop. And so this is the point, is that we have to look at alcohol as an indulgence. In the same way that you know you shouldn't eat ice cream every day, you probably shouldn't drink alcohol every day. It's not good for you. You can do it because, I'm not here to tell people what to do. You can live your own life and do your own things. You can eat the junk food. You can eat as much junk food as you want, right? No one's going to stop you. But do it with the knowledge that it's not healthy. And I think that's the point, is that if you're going to make alcohol part of your daily routine, do it with the knowledge and the understanding that it's not healthy and that you will be better off if you cut it back. I had a patient just very recently whose only problem was high blood pressure, but he would drink like 6 beers a day because that was his routine, right? And I told him, I go, look, your only problem is this. And he had very mild high blood pressure. I said, listen, if you cut back, you probably won't need blood pressure medication. Like, it's very feasible that your blood pressure is going to come back to normal if you get back. And he's like, you know what? Okay. And he was okay with it. Like, he was fine with just having 1 beer at night. So it can often be that simple and that straightforward. It's really about getting things into a more moderate and controlled fashion and just reducing our overall alcohol consumption.
Would you have any suggestions about where people can go for help if they would like to. I mean, I'm considering that we have a viewership that's outside the province. I mean, are there any good websites that you would recommend that people could also go to get started?
It's very localized, so it really depends where people are and what's available in their local area. I mean, obviously, the first point of contact is to make contact with your local medical system, right? And they can often refer you. And then you get into very complex issues of like of coverage. You know, is it going to be covered by, you know, if we're here in Canada, the various provincial healthcare systems? If you're in the US, is it going to be covered by your insurance? I think there's a growing realization that alcohol addiction is a medical diagnosis that needs to be treated. And so I think there's much less stigma. There is some stigma, but there's much less than there was before. And so getting treatment for it is important. If you're at the level where you could be at risk for delirium tremens, then you obviously do need a medical evaluation and medical treatment, you know, prescribed medication to prevent the neurological complications of alcohol cessation. So it's a very hard recommendation to give sort of blanket because you have to see what's in your area. Here in Montreal, I mean, you either, you know, there's the McGill system, there's obviously the Université de Montréal system. They do have addiction programs that exist. And so if you need help to reduce your alcohol consumption because of underlying reasons, then that exists. But for the, you know, general public who consider themselves social drinkers, I think the most important thing is to break this fallacy that we have in our head that we're fine. Because number one, you're probably not a moderate drinker. You're probably already drinking more than what the guidelines used to recommend. And then on top of that, the guidelines were actually too high to begin with. So really just try to drink less, because it's not good for you. Again, if you want to drink alcohol, you can, but think of it as an indulgence. And as long as you do it in that way, and then at least you've made an informed choice, but you've made an informed choice based on actual data, not on a statistical fallacy.
Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. And this was extremely informative. And I'm going to go back and look at when I pour and also, you know, go through some thought processes as well. This was very, very, very informative. And thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So this webcast is an initiative of the McGill Dementia Education Program, which is funded by private donations. If you would like to make a donation to our program, or if you would like to have more information about our programs and services, please go to mcgill.ca/dementia. Just as a reminder also about all of the resources that we offer, including that amazing Dementia Companion Guide that is free for all of you to download. And if you would like to join our mailing list to be notified about upcoming episodes of McGill Cares, as well as other important program initiatives and support groups, please email us at dementia@mcgill.ca. Thank you for watching.